Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in American Home Products versus Clark.
May it please the court, Mr. David Duggins will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this interlocutory appeal presents the case of 8 women from Utah, each of whom has formally admitted that she has not ever set foot in the state of Texas, and each of whom has nonetheless been permitted to join in the Johnson County diet drug litigation of Linda Gallup, a Johnson County resident whom each of the respondents has also formally admitted she has not met. None of these respondents were prescribed their drugs in Texas, purchased them in Texas, took them in Texas, or have received any medical treatment for their alleged injuries in Texas. Their claims...
Let's assume all that's true. A plaintiff just comes to town and sues several defendants, but they just pick someone off the street to sue who lives here. And that person concedes that they live here, and so now you got your lawsuit. So now you have an issue of, can they prove liability, can they prove causation, and of course they can't prove any of that. Can you bring that up on interlocutory appeal, that they sued them for the sole purpose of getting venue in this county? Can you appeal that interlocutorily?
If it is a multi-plaintiff case, yes, you can.
By claiming that it's an improper joiner, this
yes,
plaintiff...
you can attack the joiner, and you may appeal that
joiner
decision.
But the plaintiff didn't
join
anybody. The plaintiff just has sued several defendants, and they sued a defendant here. It's only one plaintiff bringing multiple defendants. And so what you're saying is any one of the defendants could come in and say, you improperly sued that defendant under the joiner?
No, if it were a single plaintiff case, a single plaintiff coming in and suing somebody off the street, no, that's not an appealable order.
Okay.
Following up on that, go ahead.
Well, that was my point. So that's a single plaintiff. Suppose you have 2 or 3 plaintiffs who all independently sue this defendant. Can other defendants come in and say, well, that's an improper, could they argue that that's an improper joinder in order to address the venue question?
Yes, they could, but they would have to do it by attacking the joinder of the plaintiffs in the case, because that is what this statute addresses, multiple plaintiff cases.
Okay.
Which of these plaintiffs cannot independently establish venue in Johnson County?
None of these plaintiffs can independently establish venue in Johnson County, except for the Johnson County plaintiff who sued her prescribing physician.
Which of these plaintiffs are suing that same physician?
None of them. The 8 ladies we have before you in this case are just the tip of the iceberg that we're looking at.
But does that make any difference?
It makes a difference
to this lawsuit and this issue.
No, it does not make a difference to the resolution of this case. It
well,
makes a difference to the importance
we can resolve
of
this case under this statutory construction issue.
All
what
over
I'm
the
concerned
state.
About
and
is,
in this case,
sir.
Sorry.
I'm concerned about is, do you agree that an order under Section 15002? Cannot be interlocutory appealed.
I yes. do not agree to
and
that
why?
In a multi-plaintiff
no.
case.
Where does it say in 15002 that a multi-plaintiff case is handled differently for appeal purposes?
It does not say that in 15002. It says that in 15003, which is a later and more specific statute directed mm-hmm. to multiple plaintiff cases.
But that's only the case when you're dealing with joinder, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
But that's only if you're dealing with the issue of joinder.
Yes, and that is how we got here. We attacked the joinder of these women from Utah in this case. We asserted that they could not meet the requisites for joinder under this statute, and we asked for them to be their claims to be dismissed for improper joinder or alternatively transferred to a proper venue.
I misunderstood. You said these ladies from Utah did not sue this doctor in Johnson County?
The doctor is named as a defendant in the lawsuit. It's just one petition. The only reason he is named, the only factual allegations against the physician in the lawsuit, are that he prescribed diet drugs to Glenda Gallup, the Johnson County resident. None of the out-of-state plaintiffs alleged any cause of action against this physician. Our challenge to joinder was overruled by the trial court.
Mr. Deggans, if you cannot bring your case within Section 15.003, then the Court of Appeals had no jurisdiction to consider the denial of your venue motion, correct?
Correct.
Now, under Section 15.003, a trial court is required to make certain determinations that were the subject of this court's opinion in the Surge Attack.
Correct.
And aren't those the very determinations that the Court of Appeal and Court of Appeals in subsection D is expected to review in an appeal from a Section 15.003 determination?
The Court of Appeals is expected to review whether the joinder or intervention is proper.
Right, that's under Section D, where the legislature has prescribed what the Court of Appeals must do during the course of its review.
That is correct.
Do we have an order in this case that the Court of Appeals could review under 15.003C as the statute prescribes? Do we have such an order?
We do have such an order.
Or do we have an order that says that the trial court did not make a determination under 15.003 and instead decided its venue issue under 15.002?
We appealed an order that generically said your motion to transfer venue and your motion to strike joinder is overruled.
And then the Court of Appeals sent it back to the trial court for clarification.
Which we believe.
That particular order, I'm just trying to make sure I'm reading the record correctly, doesn't the order say that the determination was made under 15.002 that venue was proper and that the trial court did not make any determination under 15.003?
The second order, which we contend was error in the first place, does so recite.
Okay. If it says that the trial court made no determination under 15.003, then what can the Court of Appeals review when its appellate review is specifically set out by the legislature in 15.003? I'm just trying to figure out how to get where you want us to go
in light of that prescription. What the Court of Appeals reviews is precisely what the statute tells it to review, whether the joinder or the intervention is proper based on an independent determination from the record. Now, this statute lets multiple plaintiffs intervene or join one of two ways.
So if the trial court does not issue a decision under 15.003, then under you're saying that under 15.003, the Court of Appeals in the first instance can issue a ruling based on that?
Yes, I am. And that is because this is a purely legal issue. It is done based on the record. It is, by the very terms of the statute, an independent review of the record. So, and it is, by this court's Surgitech decision, a de novo review.
So you are appealing from a failure to rule under 15.003 and asking us to hold that the Court of Appeals in the first instance can make a 15.003 determination as part of its appellate review?
Well, we appealed from a 15.003 decision. All of the evidence in the trial court was 15.003 evidence. There was never a single contention made in the trial court that any one of these plaintiffs could show proper venue.
I understand that that's your contention, that you challenged the Court of Appeals decision to send the matter back to the trial court for an additional order. But just, and I know you don't concede that point, but assume with me that that's proper. I'm just trying to understand how it is that under those circumstances, Court of Appeals has jurisdiction to review this order. Is it your position that when the trial court explicitly says, I am not ruling under 15.003 because I find venue proper under another provision, that the Court of Appeals appellate jurisdiction includes the ability to, in the first instance, make a determination under 15.003?
In a multiple plaintiff case in which joinder is challenged, yes, that is our position.
So, in fact, it's not really appellate review. It's acting almost as the trial court in the first instance.
It is de novo review, as you held that it was in the Surgitech opinion. The reason that that is our position. And the reason that that has to be the law if this statute is to be effectuated is you don't go forum shopping for the most unbiased court and level playing ground available. If the statute can be avoided, if the interlocutory appeal can be avoided simply by having a pliant trial judge sign an order finding proper venue in the face of all reality.
But now, isn't that a legislative call? I mean, if that's the scheme that they set up, that even if there's error, we can't correct it, couldn't they have more clearly made an exception for multi-plaintiff cases? Wouldn't that have been a pretty easy thing to do without all this sort of statutory meandering?
It is a legislative call, and this is what they did. The legislative intent on this statute is just as clear as a bell. I mean, in the Senate debate, just before they passed the statute that became 15003, Senator Sibley spoke to Senator Monford, who was the sponsor of this bill, and the exchange is, quote, "You know, we had an event down in South Texas where we have something like 2,000 out-of-state plaintiffs who've all piled into one place down in Eagle Pass. Does this put a stop to that?" Senator Monford replied, "Sure does, Senator. I think it will stop forum shopping. I think that that is an abuse in the system that must be addressed, and that clearly is the intent of this bill." Close quotes. So the question before this court, I believe, is whether the legislature accomplished passing this statute.
They intended this in the joinder and intervention statute, but did they intend this to be a backdoor review of all venue determinations under 15002 if there's more than one plaintiff involved? That's your argument, right?
That is the argument. It's not a backdoor review either. Look at what this statute says. It starts out in subsection A by saying that if there's more than one plaintiff joined, each has to show independent venue. That's the general rule. If you can't, you may not join or intervene in the case unless you meet these four requisites.
And so that's the starting point, is 15002.
And that is emphasized. Yes, it is. It's reemphasized in subsection B that, again, says you may not intervene or join unless you show either of two things. Number one, proper venue, or number two, those same four requisites. C provides the interlocutory appeal and provides that the Court of Appeals is to determine whether the joinder or intervention is proper. To effectuate the legislative intent and to, I think, go by the plain language of this statute, to make that determination, you have to determine two things. Did they show proper venue, or did they meet those four requisites? The statute doesn't say that the Court of Appeals is to determine whether joinder is proper under Section B2 to the exclusion of Section B1. It doesn't say the Court of Appeals is to determine whether intervention or joinder is proper under these four factors to the exception to the exclusion of the general rule also stated in the same subsection.
To move to 003, do we have to conclude that the plaintiffs from Utah have not sued this doctor in Johnson County?
You have to conclude that they have not properly pleaded a cause of action against this doctor from Johnson County.
Okay. Because is that one of the elements that the court can consider on whether this is a joint or a venue determination?
Yes.
In 003, one of the elements that the appellate court will look to is whether or not the plaintiff has stated a cause of action against the defendant that would otherwise give them that it would otherwise establish venue. That would be one of the elements in the improper joinder.
That is one of the elements of the de novo review of whether this joinder or intervention is proper.
So if these ladies sued the doctor, if they sued the doctor, but as you say, there's no showing that the doctor ever treated them, that would be a factor in determining whether or not 002 proper venue, or is that a factor in 003 proper joinder?
Both. I have to concede that under Rule 87, you presume the existence of a cause of action if it is properly pleaded. And so for showing proper venue purposes, if you have properly pleaded a cause of action against a resident defendant, you have met that test.
And what's your definition of proper pleading?
Alleging a cause of action.
And did they not allege a cause of action for conspiracy among all the defendants?
They certainly did not. There is conspiracy is not mentioned in their live pleading, nor are the elements of a conspiracy asserted in their live pleading.
They all what they said in their response is incorrect.
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay. All of their pleadings are identical. The pleading is all identical, which is they go through all the manufacturer, the product, and they get down to the doctor. Your argument is that when they get to the doctor, the pleadings only demonstrate the doctor treated one of the multiple plants.
That is correct. And the evidence is done. The evidence at the hearing is.
And you're saying it's not proper joinder because these plaintiffs really don't have a cause of action against that doctor.
They have not properly pleaded a cause of action against that doctor, and they can't in good faith. They don't have a cause of action against that doctor. If you could get proper venue.
Move from 002 to 003, the court is permitted under 003 to conclude that there's not a proper cause of action alleged against the defendant that is named.
Yes, that the parties whose joinder is being challenged have not pled an action against the local defendant that would give them proper venue. That is correct. Otherwise, if you could just pick a name out of the phone book and stick it into your petition because it was a local defendant and therefore got you proper venue, even if it's a physician who prescribes diet drugs, every single diet drug case in this country could be in Johnson County, Texas, or any other of the counties in Texas.
Well, that's the question here, isn't it?
That
is
the question.
The question is, these plaintiffs are relying on the fact that they've named this doctor as a defendant in their lawsuit to maintain venue in Johnson County, and your defense is you just can't do that. You just can't go and pick someone off the street and name them as a defendant in your lawsuit and avoid an interlocutory appeal under 003.
That is an issue. Another important issue is whether you can come up with that theory for the first time on appeal, never having presented it to the trial court in the first place. Can
passing
you go through
that
the
issue and going just to the first one, if they had alleged that every plaintiff in this case was treated by that doctor, would they have established their venue under 15002, even if at trial you could show that that was false and maybe proceed with sanctions?
Yes, Justice Phillips, they would have. If they had pled a cause of action against an individual defendant resident of that county, they would have shown proper venue in that county. And our remedy would be an appeal after judgment. It is to avoid the situation where you have people have no business in the county, piggybacking onto the claims of the one person who does have venue, that the legislature passed this statute in the first place. Its express purpose was to prevent this situation. And to effectuate that intent, the Court of Appeals should, as the statute correctly tells it to, determine whether the joinder is proper based on an independent determination from the record.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Brockman.
May it please the court, Chair McCallie will present argument for the respondents.
Ms. McCallie, but for the plaintiff Gallup, what are the remaining plaintiff's claims against Dr. Rennie?
Your Honor, what the record shows is that the claims that are pled specifically in the record on page 29, all of the claims that are pled in the petition are pled against all of the defendants that are named. But one that I want to raise with the court that shows a specificity of pleading, though it doesn't mention the doctor's name individually, is the one that's on page 29, and it's the misrepresentation claim. Plaintiffs bring a misrepresentation claim that reads, plaintiffs bring this claim against all defendants, including doctor defendants.
Well, but do you concede that there was no treatment, there was no relationship between the two, you haven't alleged conspiracy? Are you saying that you can just pick out a phone book, list the name in there, and if you plead it that way, you can get there?
I perceive two different questions here, and I think the answer to both of them is yes. Number one, I would concede that none of the plaintiffs in this case have alleged, in this appeal, have alleged treatment, individual treatment by Dr. Raines. That does not, on the other hand, mean that the petition does not allege a cause of action against Dr.
Raines. What cause of action? I guess that's my original question.
All of the causes of action are alleged, and that's really all that was before the trial court is what the pleading says. What
you
is alleged?
You have to have some liability theory, you have to have some causation theory, and damages to allege cause of action. How do these eight plaintiffs have
a liability theory, causation theory, or damages against this doctor?
Your Honor, they have one because they have pled it. And at the venue proceeding, that's all they have to do. If the court is asking me what evidence there will be, whether they will be able to meet their burden of proof, and whether or not this defendant will ultimately be proven to be a proper defendant, those are difficult questions I can't answer on this record because the trial lawyers below didn't have to answer it for the venue. That's what this court has said by Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 87.
So when the petitioner says you can pick a name out of the phone book and stick it in the pleadings, you think that's right?
Actually, I don't think that's right. This court told me that was right in Wilson versus Texas Parks and Wildlife. You said that because of the balance that has been struck by the venue statutes when read together, it's not a perfect statute, but that's exactly what happens, is that the potential for fraud in a pleading, mistake in a pleading, anything that causes a pleading to be ultimately not founded is balanced by 15.064, which is an automatic reversible error. As I say, this is not perfect venue, but what happened was that the plaintiffs got together and negotiated with the defendants, and there were four chits available, basically. There was whether or not there would be an interlocutory appeal. There was a question about what the standard or quantum of proof would be at the venue stage. Then what the standard or quantum of proof would be at the appellate stage at the end of the case if there was no interlocutory appeal. And finally, how was any defendant ever going to prove harm? They divided up those four chits, these plaintiffs and defendants, lobbyists that got together and negotiated this bill, and the plaintiffs won two and the defendants won two, and it was a compromise bill that nobody liked. And that's what we're stuck with. There's no interlocutory appeal, and a plaintiff need only demonstrate prima facie evidence of the venue facts because the cause of action, as pleaded, even petitioners accept this.
And what is your misrepresentation pleading against the doctor?
It is essentially, when you take the pleading as a whole, the misrepresentation and the facts that are incorporated therein is that the diet drugs were prescribed, they were distributed into the market without a disclosure that these were off-label uses. The two different component drugs were individually approved by the FDA, but not approved for combination use.
Essentially, your theory is that if my doctor fails to tell me something about a drug he gives me, and you're getting that drug from another doctor, you can sue my doctor for being, I guess, part of a national failure, sort of seeping out misinformation throughout the community.
That's not what the pleading says. That's possibly what the proof will bear out. The thing that I need to answer Your Honor's question with is that
I'm just trying to test if it's really been pled here.
Well,
if you have pled a cause of action on the face of this against Dr. Rain, because you're not saying these women from Utah got their medicine from a doctor in Cleveland.
That's correct.
So I'm trying to just understand, and since your pleading's kind of long, help me.
What I'm saying is that on page 29 of the record, it's illustrative of a single cause of action and the way it is pled, a misrepresentation against an individual physician. And it is pled as a misrepresentation of material facts about diet drugs that were relied upon by the plaintiffs, and that reliance upon the misinformation proximately caused their damages.
Okay. What misrepresentations were made to the out-of-state plaintiffs by Dr. Rain?
It's not contained in this record, nor was it presented to the trial court in any form. It would have been an evidentiary question not challenged by Dr. Rain.
So there's nothing in the pleadings indicating that any representations were made to the out-of-state plaintiffs by Dr. Rain?
That's not entirely correct.
Tell me the exact verbiage in the pleadings indicating that Dr. Rain made a representation to the out-of-state plaintiffs.
My recollection of the specific representation in the pleading is that false and material misrepresentations were made to plaintiffs. It doesn't say what they were, is my point.
And is there any pleading stating that the out-of-state plaintiffs relied upon any representations made by Dr. Rain?
There is that same pleading on page 29 that says the plaintiffs relied upon the defendant's representations. And that is a pleading that was never accepted to by Dr. Rains.
So does your case live or die based upon our interpretation of page 29?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does. I think as an initial consideration, this court has got to determine whether you can even look at page 29, whether or not you can undertake a review of the trial court's 15.002 determination in the face of a statute that clearly says that you cannot.
So as I understand your argument, whether or not there was collusive pleading or false pleading or blatantly wrong pleading and the trial court just absolutely erred in the worst possible way, we can't look at it, and that was the compromise the legislature reached.
That's exactly what I'm saying, that you cannot look at it now.
Well, what if your venue in Johnson County depended on Dr. Raines being a defendant, and the claim of the Utah plaintiffs was is that Dr. Raines was less than 6 foot tall? That is something that's clearly recognized as not a cause of action under our jurisprudence. Is that enough? He doesn't specially accept to the claim that he was under 6 feet tall, because in fact he was under 6 feet.
Your Honor, that'd be a very difficult question because the cases from this court and lower courts do not give us a lot of guidance about what is a proper pleading under Rule 87. But I'd have to say that the cases do exist would say, no, Your Honor, you could not review that at this point, that the trial court is not entitled under Rule 87 to do anything but presume the existence of a cause of action for
so
someone
there's no
being.
Reason for him to specially accept.
Not at all.
He was sunk anyway. I mean,
not at all, Your Honor, because Dr. Raines didn't challenge the venue. In fact, he supported the venue. There's every reason for him to specially accept if he feels that
the defendants who were not happy with the venue could specially accept as to your claim against another defendant.
They could, but they have not.
As long as you're willing to plead some cause of action and name him, that's the end of the game.
According to your decision in Wilson versus Texas Parks and Wildlife, it's the end of the inquiry today on an interlocutory basis. It's the very beginning of the inquiry at the end. In fact, it's the beginning and the end of the inquiry at the appeal, at the conclusion of the case, because if I have banked on my ability to bring that person in as a proper defendant and I am wrong about that, whether because I've deliberately done it or inadvertently done it, and a summary judgment is granted during the course of the proceedings, I lose as a matter of law. They need not ever show harm by having been in Johnson County.
You must admit, based on what you've already told us, that it's a high-risk proposition to bring this suit in Johnson County for some of these plaintiffs. Why is it so important to be there?
I can't tell you from this record why it's important to be there. I only know that this court has consistently, year after year, upheld the plaintiff's ability to choose a venue so long as it is a proper venue.
Let me ask you this. Under 15003, let's say that there was no 15002 motion. It's my understanding your present counsel says there really wasn't. This was an afterthought. But putting all that aside, let's presume there never was a 15002 motion. And we were only looking at a 15003 motion. There had been no trial court determination under 15002. We could independently review whether each plaintiff independently established a venue.
Yes, Your Honor, you could if the trial court and the Court of Appeals had made such a decision. I guess I have to, after hearing the argument today, I have to give that caveat. There's no question that 15.003C gives the Court of Appeals an independent review over the trial court's decision allowing or denying joinder. So both a plaintiff or a defendant aggrieved by a joinder decision has the right to interlocutory.
Right, and aren't we putting form over substance, which is something we rejected in Surgitech, by saying, well, because the trial court ruled under 15002, it's going to take away that independent review?
Actually, the opposite, Your Honor. For you to construe the statute as the petitioners would have you do so today is to put that form over substance. The substance is the statute itself. As you said in Abel, the substance of this statute is that the interlocutory appeal is designed for decisions allowing or disallowing joinder, not venue. It doesn't matter whether you call it venue or joinder. If it is joinder, just by virtue of the fact that the trial court in this case denied something that was called a motion to transfer venue and strike joinder, because it had the word joinder in it, that's form. Substance is that under this statute, the only way that the plaintiffs are able to maintain venue in Johnson County is by piggybacking, which is what that statute is designed to prohibit. Then and only then do you have in substance a joinder decision. But that's not the facts before the court today.
But you agree, though, that Section 15.003 is the applicable venue provision for multiple plaintiff suits. Because in the first sentence, it talks about what must happen when you have multiple plaintiffs, that each must independently establish proper venue. So it is a venue provision.
I think even this court in Abel has said that it's really not a venue provision, that it is a joinder provision, that the underlying decision must be a joinder decision, just as the statute says.
In then a multiple plaintiff case, must a trial court always make a determination about whether or not joinder was proper?
In fact, the trial court is prohibited. Under the plain language of the statute, if a plaintiff is able to independently establish venue, if a plaintiff has general venue, then the trial court cannot go on to the 15.003 inquiry.
If the trial court should have decided the joinder issue but didn't, is there any remedy under 15.003 for review of the trial court's failure to make a decision on joinder, which is what happened here? We have a trial court who specifically says in the order, I'm not going to decide the case under 15.003 because 15.002 and 15.005 take care of the venue issue. But the defendant asked for a 15.003 determination, and you all apparently also, during the course of the venue pleading battle that went back and forth, invoked 15.003 and indicated that you were prepared to prove the joinder elements in 15.003.
Correct.
If the trial court should have made a determination under 15.003 but failed to do so, which is what I understand Mr. Douglas is arguing, then what remedy or relief does the defendant have?
Your Honor, I think the only relief that they have is potentially in a case where there is no 15.002 ruling, therefore there is not a ruling on what is proper venue, then I think the failure to rule would probably be mandamusable, because there would not be an adequate remedy under those circumstances. I'm guessing here because those are facts well beyond what we have. In fact, the trial court did what the statute commanded that he do, which is not reach 15.003 because he did find 15.002. That's the problem with everything that the petitioner is saying in this case. They're telling you that in every multiple plaintiff case in which there is even an allegation, even if it's in the alternative, that a plaintiff can prevail on 15.003, that there's an interlocutory review. They don't even suggest that a plaintiff has to plead 15.003 before they get an interlocutory review of a 15.002 decision in a multiple plaintiff case. I know I'm not telling this court anything you don't know about the floodgates that would open up. It would merely, as the recent decision in American Home Products versus Adams out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, petition is pending in this court, said, even a car accident with two people, same family members, that's a multiple plaintiff case. If they say that they can sustain venue on 15.002 and the trial court agrees with them, under the petitioner's argument, they have an interlocutory appeal, the defendants in that case. Just because there's two plaintiffs, that can't be the law, and it's not what the legislative intent was. The petitioner has suggested the legislative history is as clear as a bell on this particular statute, and I couldn't agree with him more. Senator Montford went on in that discourse that was described to you to say that he did not want this statute, 15.003C, to return us to the old plea of privilege proceeding, and he was assured that that was not the purpose because the only decision that was supposed to be appealable on an interlocutory basis was a decision for joinder. And this court reaffirmed that notion in the Abel case. You didn't hear the petitioner cite any cases, not a single case from any court below, that has gone with their argument, because there isn't one.
It seems to me, though, that one of the difficulties here is it's pretty easy to envision joinder, where venue is for, like, the Polaris case, where there was somebody who had the cause of action that permitted to be down there, but the defendant didn't live down there. But where an individual defendant who's in the long string of distribution of a product lives down there, and all the plaintiffs, by looking at this case, should we decide that if you name the defendant, then you get 002, not 003,
it seems to me it produces the abuses going just the other way, which is from now on, you avoid the joiner problem by simply including the individual defendant over which there is venue in that county, not because of cause of action, but because the defendant lives there. You avoid the 03 altogether. You just name it, which is what happened in this case. Doesn't that produce a floodgate going just, well, a lack of floodgate going just the opposite? There is no appeal of an improper venue determination through the joiner process because the plaintiff will just simply name the one defendant that it lives in that county. Doesn't that create an abuse going the other way, too?
It certainly would under the way the petitioners have presented the Chicken Little argument, but there's one flaw, Your Honor, and it's the one that I mentioned before. The only way that there can be an abuse, such as Your Honor describes, is if there's collusion between that local venue defendant. That has to be presumed in every one of these cases because the way they argue it, never will a defendant stand up and say, wait a minute, I may be a venue defendant. I may live here. But that doesn't mean I want to be sued by three plaintiffs, five plaintiffs, 2,000 in Polaris. Why would a defendant stand by and allow himself to be sued when he feels there's no basis for the lawsuit by any other plaintiff other than the single lead plaintiff? That has to happen in every case for the abuses that you described to go on.
Well, but under our jurisprudence, defendants don't have a choice on whether they want to be sued or not. Isn't that correct?
True. No question.
So your argument doesn't really work out because you can't say, wait a minute, don't sue me because I don't want to be sued. But you can say later on, I need a summary judgment because I'm not liable for anything. But that's not a venue question.
No doubt about it, Your Honor, but there's absolutely nothing to prevent the venue defendant from filing an immediate special exception or motion for summary judgment. You see, again, we're not talking about American Home Products. They're not saying we don't have a claim against them. They're saying we couldn't file a motion for summary judgment because our venue had to be determined first under the due order of pleadings. The same does not hold true for Dr. Raines. If Dr. Raines did not think he was a proper defendant in this case, he could have immediately filed special exceptions to the petition or immediately filed a motion for summary judgment that would have put the plaintiffs to their proof as to him. He didn't do that in this case. No special exceptions and no motion for summary judgment.
Nor did he contest venue.
Not only did he not contest venue, he opposed the motion to transfer venue. He's the one that placed his affidavit on file saying that he was a Johnson County resident. He believes venue is proper as to this petition on this record in Johnson County, Texas. And the trial court clearly agreed with him. That's the point that we're trying to make, is that for this court to do what the defendants want you to do, the first thing you'll have to do is ignore the plain language of the statute and authorize an interlocutory appeal on every multiple plaintiff case for fear that there may be a collusive environment on a multiple plaintiff case. Then, in order to get past the second hurdle that they must, you would have to undertake not only a review of the trial court's decision that there was a pleading on file, a notice pleading, which is all that is required, and a venue affidavit, you would have to, for the first time in Texas jurisprudence, look behind the pleading to see whether or not ultimately that individual would be a proper defendant. I see that my time is up. I ask that this court affirm the holding of the Court of Appeals that there is no interlocutory jurisdiction.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
On the question of whether Dr. Raines should have or could have done anything, you point out that in this record, Dr. Raines generally denied the allegations of Glenda Gallup and asked that Glenda Gallup take nothing. That is the only answer he ever filed in this case. He certainly didn't understand that all of these people from Utah he'd never heard of were suing him.
How would your argument prevent us from going back to the general plea of privilege? I mean, that was a factor that the legislature considered. And what about the argument that this was a compromise to keep from going back to that?
The argument that she gave you was the history of 15002, not of 15003. All that compromise business was on 15002, which was enacted 10 years before the legislature determined it wasn't working. And in 1995, passed this for the very situation we're looking at today.
That wasn't discussed in the legislative history of 03 at all?
Whether there was an interlocutory appeal?
Well,
yes.
whether your interpretation could lead to going back to the days of plea.
Oh, yes, that's in the legislative history as well, and it's not. And it doesn't, because this is a very specific case. Multiple plaintiff cases are extremely expensive for the county to go through. They're extremely expensive for the parties.
But your argument would support the same result in a two-plaintiff case, and wouldn't that bring the blood back?
Yes, it would. In the car wreck case with a husband and wife suing in the same county, if the defendant challenged joinder, which would be a frivolous pleading, and then took a frivolous appeal from it, within 120 days, which is what the Court of Appeals has to do this, there would be sanctions for the frivolous appeal, and in the meantime, the trial proceedings would still go on in that 120 days because this statute doesn't stop anything from happening at the trial court. That is not such a terrible result if somebody's going to bring a frivolous appeal under those circumstances.
Perhaps it would be for the courts of appeals.
Well, after a few of those, I bet the floodgates would close up pretty quick. Now, let me revisit the question that you asked me earlier, Judge Phillips. If there is a pleading, an actual cause of action alleged against an individual defendant that is out and out fraudulent, I don't think that's enough to get by this interlocutory appeal. I think that if you have a fraudulent pleading where people from Utah file something that says, I never heard of this man, but he prescribed Fen-Phen to somebody else, and therefore I think I can sue him because not only is he under 6 feet tall, but he shouldn't have prescribed Fen-Phen to anybody. If they file that pleading that is fraudulent on its face, I think you can look beyond that, as the federal courts do in issues of fraudulent joinder for removal purposes. If there is not, under the pleadings and the evidence at the hearing, a conceivable basis for recovery against a fraudulently named defendant, then the plaintiff should not be able to rely upon that defendant for showing venue to get to joinder.
No law on that yet, I guess.
I'm unaware of any Texas case law on that, Your Honor. There's plenty of federal case law, some of which is cited in our briefing.
But there are some different considerations in federal court.
Yes.
Their courts have limited jurisdiction and then search for ways to flush cases out. We're a court of general jurisdiction and presume you belong there.
I do not disagree with that. But we are also in Texas state courts are charged to follow the legislature's statutes. This statute provides an independent review of whether joinder is proper.
Mr. Duggins, if venue was proper as to each of these plaintiffs independently, then you never reached the joinder issue, correct?
If I appealed a joinder decision and the Court of Appeals determined that venue was proper for each plaintiff, I lose.
No, sir. My question is, if I have five plaintiffs in a lawsuit and every one of them were treated by the doctor who's the defendant and he resides in Johnson County, then the venue determination is that each of those plaintiffs independently has established venue in Johnson County, correct?
And therefore they are entitled to join as plaintiffs in the case.
But we don't reach the joinder issues presented by 15003. 15003 only applies in the absence of independent venue having been established by each plaintiff.
Judge Hankinson, I disagree with that.
Okay, why?
Because the statute not only sets forth that exception that you have just articulated, it also sets out the general rule. You can't join unless you do one of two things: show proper venue or show the four exceptions. You can't intervene unless you do one of two things: show proper venue or show the four exceptions. Those are both the issues on joinder, and those are both the issues that must be reviewed de novo in the interlocutory appeal. That is what the legislature meant to do to get rid of forum shopping in this state.
Subsection C of 15003 does not provide for the Court of Appeals to review the determination of whether or not each plaintiff has independently established venue. It only provides for review of the factors listed in A1 through 4.
It does not say that, Your Honor. It says they are to independently determine whether the joinder or intervention is proper. It doesn't say only under those four factors. To get to that determination, you have to determine whether venue is proper. Well, consider the case of a plaintiff who can show proper venue, but whose joinder gets stricken anyway by an erroneous trial court. That plaintiff appeals. The Court of Appeals says, well, you could show proper venue, but therefore you're not a person seeking intervention who is unable to establish proper venue, and therefore we have to dismiss your appeal.
That's the flip side of their argument. Okay, the only way that we know whether or not a plaintiff has independently been able to establish venue is by looking at other venue provisions.
Yes. And they are incorporated into this statute.
Why isn't that then a decision by a trial court under another venue provision that is not subject to interlocutory appeal?
Because in this limited circumstance of multiple plaintiff cases, the legislature has said you can do it one, you can join one of two ways. And Court of Appeals, on an interlocutory review, you determine whether it's proper under either of those two ways.
All right, now look at the first sentence of Part C. Any person seeking intervention or joinder who is unable to independently establish proper venue may take an interlocutory appeal. There's the limitation on the appellate review that I was referring to, and that's what I'm having a hard time getting around, and I want to give you a chance to be able to explain.
I believe that's simply a description of one of the two ways. It is not a limitation upon the interlocutory jurisdiction for a couple of reasons.
Well, doesn't it prescribe, Mr. Duggins, who may appeal a venue decision? It is. And what may be appealed? A person seeking intervention or joinder who is unable to independently establish venue, or a party opposing intervention or venue, may contest the decision by interlocutory appeal. Isn't that a limitation on the appellate remedy that's provided in the statute?
I am a party opposing the joinder of 8 women from Utah who cannot show venue. There's no way around that. If that were a limitation on jurisdiction, that plaintiff couldn't appeal. And if that were a limitation on jurisdiction,
Can you say what you just said, there's no way around it, because
for review, you determine whether it's proper under either of those two ways.
All right, now look at the first sentence of Part C. Any person seeking intervention or joinder who is unable to independently establish proper venue may take an interlocutory appeal. There's the limitation on the appellate review that I was referring to, and that's what I'm having a hard time getting around, and I want to give you a chance to be able to explain.
I believe that's simply a description of one of the two ways. It is not a limitation upon the interlocutory jurisdiction for a couple of reasons.
Well, it says, doesn't it prescribe, Mr. Duggins, who may appeal a venue decision? And what may be appealed? A person seeking intervention or joinder who is unable to independently establish venue, or a party opposing intervention or venue, may contest the decision by interlocutory appeal. Isn't that a limitation on the appellate remedy that's provided in the statute?
I am a party opposing the joinder of 8 women from Utah who cannot show venue. There's no way around that. If that were a limitation on jurisdiction, that plaintiff couldn't appeal. And if that were a limitation on jurisdiction,
Can you say what you just said, there's no way around it, because that encompasses a review of the merits of the trial court's clarified order that said I decided this case under 15002 and 005. Your statement can only be made if and when a review of the merits of the trial court's clarified order is done by a court.
On the paper record in the de novo independent review in this interlocutory appeal set forth by the legislature.
And that second part of your argument is, therefore, that's what a court of appeals has to do.
And that is what the court of appeals have done. Counsel says there aren't any cases.
Well, a couple that have done it.
They have done it. They have to do it to determine whether joinder is proper. Because showing proper venue is one of the two ways that you get to join. So to determine whether joinder is proper, you have to look first, is venue proper? And if it is not, second, do you meet those four exceptions?
You say that have said that.
Excuse me?
Would you cite the cases that you say have said what you just argued?
They have done it. The Eastland Court did it in the Burroughs versus American Home case. The Corpus Christi Court did it in the Lopez-Guerra case. The San Antonio Court came right out and said it in its Masonite case, as did the Tyler Court in its 15003 case, whose name escapes me at the moment. They said review of joinder under 15003 necessarily entails review of proper venue.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second cause. The court will take another recess.
All rise.